Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Later on, we're building bridges to an emergency rally. No U.S.-NATO aggression. No more wars for corporate profit. Dollars for human needs, not war. And we'll take you there.
There is no equivalence between Russia conducting military exercises and troop movements within its own borders and NATO flying in thousands of North American and Western European troops and deadly weapons directly across those same borders. Stop the saber rattling.
We're off to the Ukraine-Russia border crisis with Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies, who cautions the U.S. stop saber rattling. Stop the provocations for war with Russia. By the way, Biden, how many borders have you transgressed? Professor, your perspective on the U.S. provocation, perhaps, or the U.S. as a good faith actor to address the crisis on the Ukraine-Russia border?
It's just so bizarre that we're even talking about a confrontation between the U.S. and Russia. It's been over 30 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. In the course of the Cold War, even though literally millions of people died in various proxy conflicts between the two superpowers, there was never a single armed confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union. Not a single Russian was killed by an American. Not an American was killed by a Russian. Here we are in 2022 with this very real risk of an armed conflict. I do have some serious issues with Putin. I think he's being very provocative by stationing hundreds of thousands of troops near the border. His annexation of Crimea in 2014 was wrong, as was arming the ethnic Russian rebels in the eastern part of the country. However, the United States seems like the last country to take any kind of leadership in countering it, especially with the risk of war. Biden is saying it's wrong to invade or threaten to invade another country on false pretenses. And this is a guy who not only supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq, not only lied about these non-existent biological weapons, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons program, SS-20 missiles, and all this kind of stuff, but as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he wouldn't even allow critics of Bush's war plans to testify. And then he stacked the hearings with all these pro-invasion people who said, oh, they got all these weapons, we will be greeted as liberators, that kind of thing. The second thing that Biden says is that no country can unilaterally change internationally recognized borders. You cannot expand your territory by force. That's true. But the United States is currently the only country in the world that has formally recognized Israel's annexation of Syria's Golan Heights and Morocco's annexation of the entire nation of Western Sahara. I mean, Western Sahara is a full member state of the African Union. It's been recognized by scores of countries, and a good chunk of it is actually liberated territory by the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, the Western Saharan recognized Western Saharan government. But if you look on State Department maps, CIA maps, any U.S. government maps, you'll see Morocco and Western Sahara as one country. You don't see that on Google or National Geographic or Rand McNally or the United Nations, only the United States. Again, this Biden's the last person to preach Russia about not expanding territory by force. And then, of course, there's the question about Ukraine's membership in NATO. The U.S. position is that Russia has no right to dictate whether or not a country is a member of whatever military alliance they want to be part of. Look at U.S. history. Look at Cuba. when they were threatened by invasion, they allied with the Soviet Union, and we saw what happened there, with assassination attempts and threats of invasion, Cuban Missile Crisis, not to mention Nicaragua and the coups in Guatemala and Chile. U.S. intervention is as far away as Afghanistan, Angola, and Vietnam, of course, because we said, no, these countries don't have any right to ally with the Soviet Union. So again, the United States is the last country to lead on the whole question of Ukraine, because hypocrisy and double standards seem to be pretty obvious to anybody who cares to look. Unfortunately, that does not include the mainstream media and most Americans.
Well, President Zelensky of Ukraine seems to be downplaying the threat by Russia. How does this play out in terms of the U.S. justification or non-justification for their stance?
Yeah, there is a certain irony there. They have the right to be a little nervous, given what Russia's done in the past, but that's very far from saying this invasion is imminent or this invasion is likely, which is the line that the Biden administration seems to be doing. In effect, it makes things very difficult for Ukraine. For one thing, it really hurts the economy, because who wants to invest in a country that's about to be invaded? It's creating some unnecessary tensions. When you're having a conflict like this, obviously you want to de-escalate tensions. So exaggerating, oh my God, they're about to invade, that simply aggravates the situation. I think the exaggeration of the threat, it may have a lot to do with just justify the United States putting in more arms, fueling the arms race there, and dispatching troops. We don't have troops in Ukraine yet, but we do have additional troops in Europe. The result of this, you know, all of these are unnecessary provocations. I mean, you know, this is what U.S. policy has been, in the sense, is poking the Russian bear with a stick. And again, that's not to justify Russian actions, but it's just to say, hey, if this is really a concern, don't do things that are going to make it worse. The whole eastward expansion of NATO is really what has not only created this crisis, but is what has led to the rise of Putin's dangerous reactionary nationalism and his power. The U.S. promised Russia that if they let the Eastern European countries go their own way, we would not expand NATO eastward. But Bill Clinton and subsequent presidents have violated that agreement. And given that Russia has been invaded four times in history from Europe, starting with Napoleon and the World Wars and the intervention of the Civil War in the 20s, through Ukraine. I mean, they've come via Ukraine. Remember, Ukraine's like our Midwest. It's fairly flat. You know, it's fairly easy for invading armies to cross. This is what has led to the fears of Russians. The Soviets lost 20 million people during World War II alone. The Biden administration, what the U.S. has been doing this time, or doing towards Russia over the years, is again just totally counterproductive. I mean, they're feeding the worst elements of both countries, reinforcing each other.
I'm interested in what your overall thought is about the Biden administration's foreign policy since they have assumed office. Can you put this aggressivity in a context for us of what the neoliberal administration has wrought?
In certain ways, Biden has been somewhat more progressive than many have expected on domestic issues. But on foreign policy, it's been pretty bad. I mean, he doesn't have the more kind of crazy impulsive kinds of things that Trump did. He is a little more interested than Trump in terms of multilateral institution thing. But on the basic issues that many of us really care about, such as human rights and international law, I mean, it's been quite bad. I mean, not only has he increased military spending, even beyond the record levels of the Trump administration. The Defense Authorization Act he recently signed into law, for example, was $20 billion more than even the Pentagon asked for. He's been continuing to support these brutal dictatorships and occupation armies around the world. I mean, he and Secretary of State Blinken have said, you know, human rights and democracy are important to America again. And they point out correctly that Trump didn't even pretend to support democracy, and how Some of his best buddies were dictators. In fact, Biden during the debate saying, under my administration, we'll stop cozying up to dictators. But that's a lie. We may not be as friendly to a Putin and some other folks as Trump was, but we are certainly backing dictators like General Sisi in Egypt. I mean, Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the world. American taxpayer spends $1.7 billion annually to prop up that brutal military dictatorship on top of a new multi-billion dollar arms sales agreement. There are tens of thousands of political prisoners. These are nonviolent political prisoners. We're not just talking about Islamists. We're talking about the very progressive, pro-democracy, secular activists that led the Egyptian revolution in 2011 against Hosni Mubarak, another U.S.-backed tyrant. Indeed, the U.S. is sending massive arms sales to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, despite serious war crimes in Yemen. The impact of the war, both from the direct attacks on civilians to the starvation and fatal diseases from the blockade, has killed as many as 200,000 Yemeni civilians. The administration denounced as terrorism a drone strike apparently launched by Houthi rebels in Yemen that landed in Abu Dhabi and killed three civilians, but refused to condemn the Saudi bombing of a city in Yemen that killed over 80 civilians, and a bombing that same day that knocked out internet service for virtually the entire country. It's the same kind of double standard, of course, we've seen for years regarding Israel and Palestine and other parts of the world. And speaking of Israel and Palestine, the Prime Minister Bennett this past week reiterated his opposition to the establishment of even a Palestinian mini-state in the West Bank and Gaza. And yet the Biden administration rejects any conditions on U.S. military aid. And then as Israeli settlers are running these rampages in Palestinian villages, torching orchards, demolishing homes as the government brings in these bulldozers and the like. Meanwhile, in Western Sahara, which even Freedom House the Moroccan-occupied Freedom House has listed Western Sahara as having the worst political rights of any country in the world, except for Syria. This is out of 210 countries. And again, U.S. arms are there. You know, they're targeting women activists and other people in the nonviolent resistance inside the in occupied territory. I could go down the list that the United of all these countries that the Biden administration is backing some of the worst dictatorships in the world. I mean, the United States is the number one backer of authoritarian regimes, and so this pro-democracy rhetoric of the Biden administration is so phony, and it's just very disappointing that the mainstream media hasn't been calling him out. I mean, I remember they said that Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan raises questions about his commitment to human rights. You know, when, of course, U.S. bombing of that country has killed tens of thousands of civilians, but they don't question the direct support the Biden administration has been giving to dictatorship.
You'd mentioned the poking of the Russian bear with a stick. Well, is the stick the threat of NATO membership for Ukraine? How else would you expect it?
I think certainly the talking about NATO membership in Ukraine is part of that. It goes back further in terms of the Republic of Georgia and the Caucasus. In fact, that did lead to a brief and very violent Russian incursion into that nation back in 2008. But I think overall, when it comes to the eastward expansion of NATO overall to all these former Warsaw Pact countries like Poland and the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, et cetera, as well as even former constituent republics of the Soviet Union, like Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, the Baltic republics. And a lot of it is just sort of the triumphalism and hubris, you know, after the end of the Cold War, treating Russia as a third-rate power. And the very fact that the United States is spending more on its military now than it did in the Cold War, even counting for inflation. You know, we're not signaling to the Russians that we are really interested in a more cooperative relationship, which has really just, again, fueled the most negative aspects of the Russian state that Putin is using. And indeed, he, ideologically, he's much closer to right-wing populists like Trump and Orban and Duterte and Bolsonaro than he is any socialist kind of leaders. When you're dealing with people like that, you need to have much smarter foreign policy than what we've seen out of the seen from the United States in recent decades. And again, we're making the problem far worse.
Take neoliberals. Some people might refer to them as liberal networks, cable networks like CNN and MSNBC, who have become red baiters, virulent in their antagonism and their provocative character towards Russia in this instance, and have gone ballistic over the Fox News, the so-called right media, who, such as people like Tucker Carlson, who on the other hand are much more reticent in their aggressivity to Russia. And if anything, have been holding back and been more, for whatever reason, introspective or at least quiet on the Eastern Front in terms of attacks. So here it's most peculiar. We have the CNNs and liberal media attacking the Tucker Carlsons and the right-wing media, who has been more reticent and reserved in their aggressivity towards Russia. I mean, how do you look at the politics of those?
It is rather bizarre. I mean, to begin with, Putin may have gotten his start under the KGB under communist rule, but he's no communist. He's no red. He's right wing as hell, and of course that's what where his appeal is to people like Tucker Carlson and the like. That it's nice that they're not doing all this saber rattling, but I think they're supporting him for the wrong reasons. I mean, in terms of CNN, MSNBC, and the mainstream media. I mean, I think there's this myth that, because they were in the forefront of challenging the dangerous and racist and autocratic tendencies of the Trump administration and Trump supporters, that, oh, they are therefore progressive. They have generally always been part of the broader consensus in support of empire, in effect. I mean, they did not question so many of the assumptions of the so-called war on terrorism, the invasion of Iraq, and the like. It's quite striking that, in general, the media, news media, have not only been questioning some of the militaristic and aggressive policies of the Biden administration, but they have attacked him from the right, such as his withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was long, long overdue. And in certain ways, there's nothing that surprises me, that there is a long-standing tendency that did not change with the end of the Cold War. The mainstream media walking in lockstep with the military-industrial complex on many of these pressing international issues in a time of potential crisis, a potential war. It is incredibly irresponsible, and I think it's really critically important that we challenge this myth of a so-called left-wing or even liberal media. They are very, very militaristic and very much into preserving the status quo.
Professor Zunis, I want to thank you for joining us. This is a predicate to really taking on more specifically your particular expertise on Western Sahara, looking at war, nationalism, and conflict irresolution, which we will do in future programming. But thank you so much for your synopsis of this very frightening period that we are in now as we confront Russia.
Professor of Politics and International Studies, Stephen Zunis, thanks for being with us to speak truth to power.
Mimi takes us to an emergency rally. No U.S. NATO aggression, no more wars for corporate profit, dollars for human needs, not war, and we'll take you there.
Peter Dolick, what brings you here to protest against the U.S. NATO saber-rattling against the reality of 100,000 troops, we are told, massing on the Ukraine border, the issue of self-determination for Ukraine? Isn't that a reactionary position?
The U.S. doesn't care about Ukraine's sovereignty or autonomy. If we look under the surface, we can begin to get the answer to what's going on here in one single word, gas, as in natural gas. What is the first punishment that the United States wants to give Russia? They want to cut off all oil exports from Russia into Germany and to the rest of Europe. How will the U.S. make up for that? So it will be gas imports from the United States, that they've already promised they wanted to do. What is the outcome going to be of this if they cut off all gas exports into Europe from Russia? It'll be more fossil fuel production here in the United States and definitely a lot more fracking. So the interests of oil and U.S. multinational capital is really what underlies this. The U.S., they care about expanding the power and the reach of U.S. multinational capital, and that's what's really going on.
If you watch the Tucker Carlson's and generally Fox News and so on, they are taking a much calmer position. So I'm just interested in how you look at the incursions and the saber rattling of the neoliberals in particular, and yet the acknowledged kind of semi-fascist right forces are much more reticent to be pushing to exacerbate the situation, sending troops over and the like. Your thoughts?
There are some philosophical differences here. The neoliberal wing of conservatism, or the right wing, tends to be more internationalist. They're internationalists in the concept that you're always looking to push U.S. power, the power of U.S. multinational capital, into as many places into the world, to every nook and cranny around the world. So they have a more international perspective, and when problems arise somewhere in the world, they leap to their feet and say, okay, how can we take advantage of this? And that's what they're trying to do with this. But the more fascist-oriented ones are more of the so-called America First type of people who follow Trump. They're less interested in international adventures or imperialist invasions, because they don't necessarily have the interests of capital behind them there. So they're looking at it from a more nationalist or even ultra-nationalist perspective. America first, to hell with the rest of the world. It's not a very sophisticated way of looking at it, but that's the way they tend to look at it. And if you look at who are Putin's friends, it tends to be the far right wing. It's Le Pen and it's people like that. It's the AfD in Germany. It's Le Pen in France. And it's Orbán in Hungary. The far right is shading off into fascism there. And while I would be very hesitant to call Putin a fascist, I really wouldn't use that term for him. He's a right-wing Russian nationalist with a populist base. You know, he's looking out for Russia from that standpoint of view. And of course, you know, overlaying over this, which of course is not talked about in the corporate media, of course, is the fact that there was the handshake agreement at the fall of the Soviet Union that NATO would not be expanded. Russia accepted that Germany would be united under West German, and therefore the West, and that also the three Baltic countries would be aligned with themselves with the West. But beyond that, there will be no push of NATO and no push of the U.S. further into Russia. And, of course, that's been ignored all the way through. There's a cartoon going around where it has a showing of all these U.S. bases, dozens of them, completely surrounding Russia right up to the border. And the captain says, Russia wants war. Look, they put their country right next to all our bases. So, you know, you have to look at it also from Russia's point of view. They do have a point, however much we may dislike Putin. And I'm somebody who certainly is not aligned in any way with Vladimir Putin, but you have to admit that people in Russia have a point. They're being encircled. They're the waters of NATO are being pushed all the way up to there, and Ukraine is kind of like the final red line for them. There is a solution to this. It's NATO out of Ukraine and autonomy for the Donbass region, where you have Russian-speaking people of Russian ethnicity who identify more with Russia than they do with Ukraine. There was an agreement several years ago at the last flare-up of this that there would be some measure of autonomy given to those Russian-speaking interests, and the Ukraine government, installed by the U.S., of course, has ignored that and trampled on the rights of the Russian speakers in the Donbass region. So the solution is at hand. If there really were to want to be a solution, you can implement these kinds of agreements and give autonomy. Ukraine is a multinational country. It's not a pure Ukrainian country. But this is obviously not what is in the interest of the United States and, the multinational capital that underlies the reasons for U.S. imperialism.
And how do you assess the government of Ukraine?
Well, it's obviously a far right-wing government. I mean, it has fascist elements aligned with it. That was very obvious at the time when the government was imposed. The U.S. Helped to grease the skids to get the previous elected government pushed out of office, and that leader, Vukanovich, had to literally flee the country and go to Russia. And you have now a hardline right-wing, very Ukrainian nationalist that does not recognize the rights of the Russian speakers and the ethnic Russians in the eastern part of the country, in the Donbass region, who have been there for millennia. You know, Russians and Ukrainians are very close to the other people. It's not like these are people who are starkly at odds with each other. So, you know, you have to do a lot of effort to really put the Russian and Ukrainian people at odds like the way of this. So, again, nationalism never has a good result. You know, this Ukrainian nationalism is being exploited by the U.S. and by Western interests here. And again, we really need to tamp down the nationalism, respect the ethnic and language differences among the peoples of Ukraine, and find a peaceful way. There is a peaceful way out of this situation, and that's what the route that should be taken.
And how do you wish to be identified?
Pete Dolek, with Trade Justice, New York Metro.
And Pete, why don't you tell us what your last book is, because I still encourage people to read that.
Thank you, Mimi. My first book is It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment, which is a history of socialism, including the whole history of the Soviet Union and what happened with there, but also other things. And my next book, which will be forthcoming from Autonomy Media a little bit later this year, is What Do We Need Bosses For? A study of economic democracy and societies that have tried to build an economy other than on capitalism, most of which, of course, wound up being undermined by the U.S.,
Thank you for speaking with us, and we'll have you back, of course, when the as a preview on your new book.
Saying no U.S. NATO aggression, no more wars for corporate profit, dollars for human needs, not war. Agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so. For Building Bridges, I'm Amy Rosenberg with Ken Nash.